Hi, I'm Michael Silverblatt. On the occasion of the 25th anniversary of Art Spiegelman's Pulitzer Prize-winning graphic novel Mouse, and to mark the release of his new book, Meta Mouse, I hope you'll enjoy this re-airing of Bookworm's first interview with Spiegelman from 1992. In it, he tells us how he aimed to use comics not as a pleasurable narcotic, but as caffeine, to wake you up.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. My guest this afternoon is Art Spiegelman, the author of the Mouse books, Mouse, A Survivor's Tale, and Mouse, Part 2, and Here My Troubles Began. This book was just published by Pantheon. He's the editor as well of Raw magazine, and probably one of the people who've altered the face of comics permanently. I wanted to start by talking about the way in which comic books usually defy gravity, offer superheroes, take off into space, whereas these books seem to be about powerlessness, and thereby, you know, are the antithesis of what most people look for in comic books.
Yeah, I suppose it's become a medium of escapist entertainment, and that's kind of moving in an opposite direction. Like, as opposed to trying to make comics into a narcotic, I'm trying to make comics that can kind of wake you up, like caffeine comics that get you back in touch with what's happening around you. On the other hand, comics also have had a tradition that includes very much like being used as barometers of moral behavior. There's a satirical tradition in comics that is involved not in fantasy, superhero, Manichean escape adventure. Like today, reading in the newspaper that when asked about what to do about the economy, George Bush says, move Doonesbury to the obituary page.
Oh, boy. Well, you know, he knows.
They do have an impact, you know.
Well, sure. You know, when I go back and look through those pornographic Popeye comics that were once, you know, there are hundreds and hundreds of pages of them. And, you know, the culture wanted to do something to this spinach-chewing superhero. And the same thing, too, you know, to look at Fearless Fosdick in the Little Abner strip and see here was someone who was tired of Dick Tracy, you know.
But Dick Tracy is already a sinister, intense id creature, you know, that essentially this is like often cartoonists kind of admiring each other and trying to inhabit each other's skin rather than like just simply antidote. What's true in both cases is that there's an attempt to, in both Fearless Fosdick and these Tijuana Bible comics, of getting underneath the sanitized part of what comics can be, in that there's always been in our popular culture kind of a tension between genteel and lowbrow, you know, and comics have always sort of resided in the lowbrow, and there have been attempts to kind of reel them back in. I mean, Dick Tracy and Popeye are about as sawdust and tinsel as it gets, and yet even there.
I wanted to start our talk about Mouse in another area entirely by talking about Henry Darger and the obsessive, compulsive nature of comic fantasy. You know, I first saw some of Darger's stuff in, I guess, Wet magazine. Mm-hmm. He was, I think, a janitor in a girls' school who had composed book after book after book. It's a book I long to read of what happened in an amusement park during a 10-second cyclone, is it? And on his walls, when they went into his room afterwards, were vast frescoes of the girls in different battles being impaled, and it seemed to me to represent more than any way I could think of that life of the person who has to protect himself by projecting images.
Okay. I suppose what it is it's a result of a brain that, like, is trying to make itself known to itself, and it functions somewhere between words and pictures. So the Dodger kept all of these notebooks that were the stories of the Vivian sisters, and then started illustrating these pictures, you know, these stories with notebook after notebook of images, trying to make the world more conjured up more clearly for himself.
And I think of that cyclone, you know, a cyclone in an amusement park. This was a prose project of his, as being, you know, the vision of a world of one in which permanent catastrophe occupies a playground. You know, there's a very bitter, excluded middle here.
Yeah, but actually, it wasn't that wasn't the only thing he wrote. I mean, he was doing this other thing that was just this war between these different races on different planets.
And, right, and there was an enormous journal in which he kept the weather for every single day for the last, 25 years?
Yeah, just comparing his, the weather report with the actual weather, which was a way of proving the media around him wrong, I guess.
So I wanted to begin by comparing you to Dodger.
Okay, well, I think one difference would be that Dodger wasn't aware that his work would ever be seen. You know, it was all just discovered after his death and because his landlord... This is work we've published in Raw, and... It's just that his landlord, after he died, was an artist of sorts himself and knew that this stuff had value. Otherwise, it would have all just ended up in a dumpster. And although I do work to make things clear for myself, there is an awareness that somebody's looking somewhere, that somebody's going to be looking over my shoulder. I don't think it acts so much as a censor, but it does act as a prod to make things as to bring things into a crystalline focus that can exist without my hand pointing.
It seemed to me, though, that for something to be as visceral, as simultaneously cooled out and intense as Mouse is, that there has to be, I don't know, so much more, as you call it, rawness or intuition or personal need. Art seems to be the subsequent factor, you know, something that comes in almost by default. You need it. It's another ingredient. But the primary seems to be the need to settle or organize
the
material.
The motor is the need to clarify. But where the coolness comes in, I suppose, is that the organizing principle is a result of weighing possibilities. And it's not something that's just accreted in a notebook like Dodger. I mean, there are differences, I guess, what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. Although I certainly responded strongly enough to, like, seeing these Dodger things to want to, like, find a way to show some of it in Raw. But I suppose I knew I was making something. I knew that, like, I was working toward a specific narrative arc. You know, like, when I started it, I'd made an outline. You know, so I knew that I was going to get from A to B somehow, even though I didn't know it was going to take 13 years to get there. And then I had to inhabit every moment of that to get from that first point to that last point. But I suppose just knowing that you're aiming somewhere, already indicates a degree of artifice that probably was less true for Dodger, let's say.
I am not being fair, perhaps, to the listeners who I am supposing already know that Mouse is the story of your father and the years it took him prior to Auschwitz, to Auschwitz, and then eventually to the Catskills, that this story is told via mice as the Jews and cats as the Nazis, and your wife, a French woman, at one point was thought to be a frog, which she converted, and so she is a mouse too. And yet whimsy is not a part of the ongoing procedures here. How did you exile it? I mean, it seems necessary to have, you know, taken whimsy and said, you know, it will take a back seat, but was it of concern to you?
Well, there's a number of things that are of concern to me, that whimsy just being one of several inappropriate methods to proceed with, so that I had to avoid a kind of cheap cynicism that comes with the underground comics territory I tend to walk around in. I had to also steer clear of any kind of sentimentality or pathos, so that I wouldn't be guilty of creating some kind of holokitsch literature. And I also had to watch out for what aspects of the story can legitimately allow for laughter without saying, okay, now it's time for a good laugh, now it's time for a good cry. I really, as I was trying to indicate, tried to stay clear of manipulating into an emotional response. I was trying to withhold emotional response long enough to allow for some kind of understanding. And yet within that, there are things that happened between me and my father that can only be described as funny. There's a kind of cognitive dissonance between us that keeps creating odd collisions. And even on occasion within the ghetto, my father, who's a rather good storyteller, tells me these anecdotes that he knew were amusing.
When one opens the book and, you know, sees the harsh black and whites, one thinks not only of the graphic novels of Mazariel, but also in an odd way of the demented geometrics of Little Nemo. There's that kind of intense organization of material into discrete bits. And because the concentration camp experience is, as has been said elsewhere, the experience of repetition with terror, there is the quality here that they imputed to Desaad. They said ultimately the tendency of cruelty, when ordered, is that it results in geometry.
Wow. Well, okay. I came at it, I suppose, a little bit differently, which is I thought of this thing as trying to structure and visualize something that was, for me, not visualizable. And the only way to do that is to, like, move toward a kind of abstraction. And in terms of, let's take, since you mentioned him, Winsor McCay, Little Nemo, what was important for me in his work didn't have to do so much with the ways of drawing so much as the ways of structuring a page, so that at some point I was looking through a dictionary and I found comics means a narrative series of pictures. Narrative means a story comes from the medieval Latin historia, which is the medieval picture windows. And therefore the word story as in narrative is the same as the word story as in stories of a building. And McKay was the architect of comics. I mean, he was somebody who dealt with this amazing fantasy architecture in Little Nemo, and his pages have a kind of architectonic rigor that I found necessary to understand to compose the pages of Mouse.
It seems to me that is the thing, that there is a rigor and a squalor operating simultaneously in each page, and I guess this
That's
is
nice
the
to hear. Yeah, I like hearing
the raw
together.
And the cooked. Well, let's talk about the rawness, the necessary rawness of a text like this.
Of Mouse?
Of Mouse, yeah.
Well, I mean, unlike some other comics that I've done, this is one in which I'm at service to a deposition. My father's text is driving it. You know, so there's other things that have grown up around an image that explodes in my head and turns into other images surrounding it and eventually builds itself outward into enough boxes to be a comic. But here it was like trying to inhabit my father's words and not give lie to them. And that was a very different way of having to proceed. And so I had to go about it by trying to like get everything very like structured and then within that not allow it to become domesticated and die on me. And so I suppose there's a look in Mouse. I like the phrase that you just used in that there's an incredible amount of underlying work before the final picture, and yet the final picture has to look casual enough to not be off-putting in the sense that I am the artist, and therefore I have more skills than you, the reader, and I can keep you away from this just by the fact that I can draw circles around you, and you've got to respect it. And it was necessary for me to do all my drawing, but keep that drawing in check, you know, so that sometimes the drawing would get too interesting and I'd have to kill it. You know, I had this quote up above the drawing table that said, writing consists primarily in killing your little darlings, Faulkner. And as a result, I had to scrap things when they got too finished.
Yeah, no, it seems to me, I guess some of my favorite work takes incompetence in the face of extreme ability as its watch cry, as its lantern. And so Beckett, for instance, or Kafka as well, you know, one senses the steely precision of what they do, and yet at the same time they've thrown away all of the trappings, the beauty part.
Mm-hmm. You know, well, what I have to do in Mouse, for instance, I don't know if you've ever seen other comics originals. Mm-hmm. They tend to be quite large compared to what you see printed. And it's a way for the artist to kind of minimize his mistakes. His errors get reduced when they're printed small. And I did Mao's the same size. What you see when you look at my book is a one-to-one relationship.
It's not relationship. A scale.
Mm-hmm. And that's the real reason. It's a one-to-one relationship. If I make a mistake, I want you to have my mistake. Mm-hmm. There's an intimacy that is accorded that way. And that was part of the reason for drawing small. It keeps you from getting involved in a certain kind of flourish that and decoration, in that if you only have, as I do, sometimes an inch and a half of space or less by 2 inches or 3 inches of space in which to draw 30 people, you're not going to get involved in a lot of extraneous nonsense. You're going to go for the immediacy and the urgent sign.
Well, what struck me was that, you know, one's involvement with these books, with the Mouse books, has to be myopic. You hold them very close to you because you are looking at them. You're interrogating them in a peculiar way. And what's more, that myopic involvement precludes distance in a text that you want to keep far away
yes.
from you.
Mm-hmm.
These two books, Mouse and Mouse 2, are very much Lest We Forget books, you know, books that want to prohibit forgetfulness, loss of memory.
Mm-hmm.
Both the memory of your father, the memory of the Holocaust, you know, that these are books that are against repression.
Mm-hmm.
And I found the closeness with which you have to handle them to be technically, you know, an embodiment of that.
About memory, I've thought of these things as this 13-year-long Yahrzeit candle.
Yeah.
You know, that there was a long act of trying to organize memory. And oddly enough, you know, because I've been drawing these tiny panels, my eyes have been going, so I have to hold the book far away from me in order to see it.
In the course of doing this, because this is, I guess the regnant phrase is Hannah Arendt's the banalization of evil, about the concentration camps. These are very methodical comics.
Mm-hmm.
While there are surprises, as your psychoanalyst Mouse says, the concentration camps were like a time when there was a lot of people going boo all the time. But they're all unpleasant surprises, terrible surprises. Did you feel, you know, the cartoons in Raw are the most outlandish and surprising, visually amusing and shocking? Did you find yourself, how to put it, defining your work in contrast to that of your friends?
Not at all, because I was surprised to hear you, after being so sensitive with language, clumping together all these other artists into one category.
No,
you know,
but
that ultimately, what's interesting to me about Raw is that each of these artists inhabits a unique territory. That there's very little of them using each other's premises of what a comic strip is and means.
Mm-hmm.
So that Linda Barry's work is much more, in some sense, conventional in its comics telling than an artist like Pascal Dory in France, who we've used in Raw. And that I felt myself, while working in the early days of Raw especially, as an equal moving in one territory where there were 30 other people moving into their own terrains.
What I meant was not to group them all together. I meant that as an object, when one finds it, Raw is very much enunciates itself as something wild.
Mm-hmm.
It has many different kinds of paper. Some of its texts are colored. Some of them are tinted. You know, there's every kind of line imaginable in it. So it's mm-hmm. very, what would you, variegated. And, you know, the Mouse text is strict, you know. And so I was just thinking about the spirit of the object.
Well, I would say the main thing is just that, in that everybody has their own territory. Gary Panter's stuff, you'd never even think of calling a graphic novel unless you were just taking it because it was a word in the air. Graphic novels having this problem of graphics are respectable, novels are respectable, graphic novels double respectability. But his stuff, if anything, would be, what, graphic paintings? and on the other hand, out of all of the people that curse could be laid onto, Mao's comes closest to being a graphic novel, in that I don't like the word, obviously, but in that, a novel has a very specific kind of set of literary structurings, of ways of revealing information, that I indeed used a number of those models in trying to figure out how to make Mouse. Now, not how to make all my comics that I've made in my life, but how to make Mouse, in that, as I said before, this is a story that's motored by the word. And the pictures have to inhabit those words, as opposed to different possible directions for the words and pictures to cohabit. And as a result, novelistic structuring was necessary.
What are some examples of novelistic structuring in Mouse?
Well, for me, I suppose, you know, it's the kind of stuff you learn in lit classes. So that,
the flashbacks?
Well, foreshadowings of information, being shown something and then having it made more resonant by something that happens as many as 60, 70 pages later. Even to a simple example would be just using this kind of introductory two-page comic strip about me and my father when I was 10 years old. He's sawing. I fall down. My friends don't wait for me. I come back crying. And I complain about the fact that my friends left me. And he says, well, come on, hold this while I'm sawing. Friends, I'll tell you what it is, friends. Try to put them in a room together with no food for a week and you'll see what it is, friends. Well, all of a sudden this kind of shadow falls across a very kind of banal, non-historical moment, you know, of just being a kid and playing. And the shadow of a pastime interweaving with a present time is one of the central themes of Mouse, and it's introduced in that fashion, very kind of straightforwardly. Later on, there's a lot of other ways in which time interweaves, so that my father and I and Francoise are driving in a car in the Catskills, and as we get into the car and drive into the forest, there are corpses hanging from the trees. It's one of the few moments where I allow it to visually intersect, but it's another way of showing these different times inhabiting the same space. And in fact, if you don't mind the sentence that's running on forever, I would say that comics in their essence are about time made manifest spatially, in that you got all these different chunks of time, each box being a different moment of time, and you see them all at once. And as a result, you're always in a comic being made aware of different times inhabiting the same space. And that's a theme of Mouse. I would say that in Volume 1 of Mouse, there's a comic strip within the comic strip called Prisoner on the Hell Planet that I'd actually done years before doing the rest of the book. And that's entered into the story in a certain way. And in the second volume, there's a kind of balancing that might be novelistic, which is to have a sequence that exists outside of the frame of the rest of the book, which is the one you were referring to, of me and the psychoanalyst sitting around, the therapist sitting around together. And there are correspondences between these two sequences that they're not the same. They're not the same kind of sequence, but they definitely pull the narratives taut in different temporal and spatial directions. And that's something that I would think would be more easily understood in a work that was prose. The problem with the word novel here, of course, is that it implies fiction. And I've been very insistent that Mouse is nonfiction with mice.
This is a kind of tough question. And given the fact that, for better or worse, the primary audience for Raw and the underground comics is a kind of underground audience, a couple of years would have been a punk audience. And this was an audience that had taken swastikas as an article of fashion. Were you concerned about the appropriation of this text to purposes very different from your own?
Well, no, in that although Mouse was embraced within a punk scene, I always felt like I was flying under false colors. You know, I remember when, in the underground comics days, Bill Griffith and I were doing a magazine called Arcade. And at that point, we got a letter from Charles Bukowski saying, you guys are all ministers in Popeye suits. And essentially, there's a great moral center to the work, even though it appears on the surface to be nihilistic or anarchistic or something, that most of the artists in Raw, I won't say every single one, but most of the artists in Raw are moving forward from a moral center. And as a result, it just seemed to me interesting to be able to make ethics hip.
That puts it well. Your father was alive when the first sections came out. Had he seen them?
Yeah. But insofar as he had a response, it's included within the work.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as part of this great self-referential process of trying to re-swallow everything that was happening, there's a page within the book in which I'm showing him an earlier page. And that pretty much condenses his responses.
But what I didn't really mean to ask what his response was so much as the way in which these books become him. By the end of the book, it's his tombstone.
Mm-hmm.
That these books are, or his testament. And I guess I wondered, you know, it's very unusual, maybe there are other examples that I don't know, for this kind of art, for comic book art, to become testamentary.
I can't think of another example. Well, no, I can't think of one other example, which would be, it was a comic book for children, and it was called Hiroshima Again. Do you know about this thing? It was done by a guy who was a kid in Hiroshima when the bomb fell.
And no, I don't know it.
Then he became a professional cartoonist in Japan, where being a cartoonist meant you could make a living. And
a good living.
You could become a god king of manga. And as an adult, he started doing these stories about a young boy who survived Hiroshima, and they became a several thousand page work. And they're very much engaged in bearing witness, although through a very different idiom and for children. And yet, nevertheless, I saw it after I'd already started Mao's. Part of it had been translated by the War Resisters League. And I found this kind of chilling thing, which is even in a comic strip idiom that's much grosser than the one I've been using in Mao's. You know, the eyes are all Walter Keane, giant mirrors.
Orphan eyes.
Yeah. And when the father wants to, like, pat the kid on the head before the bomb falls, he sort of gives him a noogie on top of the head. It's like this big child abuse-like whack that, like, gets the eyes to cross and the kid to almost fall over, and it just means sign of affection in Japanese comics. And yet, through all of that exaggeration, what comes through is so chilling and burns its way so far into your brain that I would say though the descriptions of the Hiroshima bombing in Gen of Hiroshima are more firmly etched inside me than many of the written or photographic testaments I've seen.
I've been talking to Art Spiegelman. I wanted to say that I'm grateful for the existence of the Mouse books. I can hardly look at them for more than a couple of pages without crying, but I've read the first one many times and the second one twice, and it satisfies something in my heart or my soul that the books exist, and that is very, you know, a great cultural relief.
Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Bob Carlson. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
Books. Books. Books are your friends, my friends. Books keep you company. Books take you across the sea and down along a trail that never ends. To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of ice and snow in books. As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold in books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of ice and snow in books. As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.